Hello everyone and welcome to JFG tonight for this AMA night. There are a bunch of people. I just banned one. There are a bunch of people who come here to call me a cuck. I don't know why, but when you see these waves, there's someone. There's someone who tweeted about me or someone who sent his armies of name callers to us. Well, so be it. You know, I've been on the internet long enough. I will not be affected emotionally by this. How are you doing, people of the regular chat? Today I've been watching through the Amber Heard testimony at the Johnny Depp v. Amber Heard trial for defamation. And I think it's going exactly as I predicted, which is it's going to be very hard for Johnny Depp to win. The problem is here she is telling the story of their relationships, which, of course, in her testimony, what comes out is Johnny Depp is abusive and always on drugs, and he has multiple personalities. He even refers to a part of himself as the asshole, and he says, "I've killed the assholes, we're done with it, I'm never gonna beat you again." Now, you can believe parts of it, and it's definitely the case that from the other pieces of evidence, it's very easy to understand that the Amber Heard testimony is very unilateral. It's very one-sided. But so be it. I mean, you only get the idea that Johnny Depp is an abuser, and from the testimony of Johnny Depp, you get the idea that it was a mutually abusive relationship. But the problem is the videos don't lie, and the juries have seen the video. They will recognize a Johnny Depp that was angry, that was breaking plates and hitting on the walls. And it's very, very easy to make the link in your brain between, okay, I've seen this video of him being drunk and being disorderly and drinking a lot of wine. And I can totally imagine that, therefore, when Amber Heard says, okay, here's another thing that he was doing when he was drunk, he was hitting me, it's going to be very easy for the jury to believe this. And so even if all of what she says, that part of this would be a lie, I don't see where you can get to the point of saying Johnny Depp has absolutely never committed a single act of abuse against Amber Heard. To me, it's clear that they both were abusing each other. People, like, you have to understand how hard it is to commit zero acts of abuse against someone who's specifically abusing you. You have to have cold blood. You have to have extremely low emotion. You have to have enormous self-control. Most people are not capable of this. Capable of taking in the abuse and not responding. But that's basically what Johnny Depp would have had to do to be able to win a defamation case. Because I don't get it. Why didn't Johnny Depp include other causes of action than defamation? Like intentional inducement of emotional distress. He would have had a point. Now, the problem is she probably would have opened a cross case where he would have been liable also for his intentional inducement of emotional distress. So probably Johnny Depp tried to keep it clean with defamation, but the problem is I don't see any defamation here. I mean, I can even say it here on this show. My view is that Johnny Depp committed some acts of abuse against a very evil woman. A woman who herself was an abuser, but it's not defamation to say Johnny Depp is an abuser also. When you intimidate people by breaking doors, snapping doors and glasses, that's enough to me. All right, we have some of the trolls still coming onto the chat. I wonder where they come from, because who would talk about JF? I mean, I've been annoying no one. Who's the e-celeb talking about me, sending me all of these trolls, attacking me on my personal life? I don't know. Meanwhile, also people are recovering from the big announcement that that the Supreme Court will be reversing Roe v. Wade, an earth-shattering moment for a Supreme Court already on the brink. The U.S. Supreme Court's legitimacy has been deeply pierced, and it may never recover its stature in the eyes of America. That's all ridiculous leftist framing, because they want to say, oh, there was a leak, and this has never happened before, therefore the legitimacy of the court is to be questioned. You guys have made the leak. It's probably a leak that comes from the leftist side. You know, you wouldn't leak this document if you're on the majority side reversing Roe v. Wade. So you made this leak. You are trying to discredit the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has not been discredited. You're just a bunch of little leftist revolutionaries who are like, just like you were doing under Trump, like, I am in the government. I am an agent of the resistance. Yeah, yeah. And we have someone taking themselves in the Supreme Court for some agent of resistance who needs to warn women about the loss of rights that they should expect. So be it, but it's not a discreditation. By the way, tonight is AMA. You can send me questions on the regular chat. You can send a super chat. My favorite platform for super chats is Odyssey. Use the dollar button under the regular chat. You can also use Entropy to send questions and super chats. The link is below the video. And if you'd like to appear on the show, join me on Discord. The link to the Discord is in the description. And join the waiting room on your left. And when I see someone in the waiting room and I'm ready to talk to you, I will slide you in. Make sure that your microphone and earphones are prepared, because you won't be hearing. You need to mute your Odyssey when you talk to me on Discord. Prometheus says, "Do you think there is?" He sends a super chat. Thank you so much. He says, "Do you think there is any truth to the claim that Jews have a high percentage of Neanderthal DNA, or maybe some other intermixture with a species we don't know about yet?" No, I've never seen anything like this. In general, the white population has some amount of Neanderthal genes, and the Asians also. So that will also apply to the Jews that are white. I would have to check if they have maybe less or more than us, but I suspect it will be around whatever is the European average, or not so far from it, for Ashkenazi Jews, of course. So no, I've never seen any claim like this. And as far as intermixture with a species we don't know about yet, that seems extremely improbable. because the history of the Jewish people, I mean, at best, is 5,000 years. And something tells me that the modern Jews, you could date them back to small populations within much less than 5,000 years. So It would be very surprising if they were differentiated from the rest of humanity in such a radical way as to include genes from another species. I just don't know how that would happen. I find this absolutely improbable. Leftist resistance was promising war on Twitter. "You take away our rights to abortion? I promise you this, we are coming for your guns, your tax-free churches, and your Viagra. You didn't just poke the bear, you poked every woke woman, every interracial couple, every LGBTQIA. We will not back down, we will double down and win." Oh my god, and with the image of a woman superhero, the leftists are pissed off. Well, so be it. It's funny to see them say this. Other women were suggesting a sex strike. Okay, like do your sex strike. Of course, sex strikes don't work. Like people who participate to a sex strike are just the kind of people you wouldn't expect to be in high demand on the sexual market. So go ahead, do your things. That's what I declared yesterday, basically, and I've embedded my thinking in a Gab post and a post on Telegram, which people seem to have appreciated. Basically, we're going to use the state to control women's bodies, because they use the state to control our bodies. And my wish is that one day they are willing to have a discussion and make a peace agreement. But I will get the state out of your pussy when you get the state out of my wallet. Simple as. And as long as you continue using the state to take my wallet and to take other private liberties of mine, like medical decision making, I'm not interested in discussing. I'm not interested in a peace deal. So that's what we have to do right now. Even if you are like me and you have libertarian tendencies, you have to participate to the hilarity of of seeing a right that was attributed not by the Constitution but by a bunch of justices. It was just decided that a progressive right was given to the people, to the woman, and this was decided 50 years ago, and now it's disappearing. NDBL says, what did the knife DNA test look like? 25% Indian? Oh, I don't know that. Shakespeare says, there is probably some Asiatic version of JF somewhere out there. I don't know, bro. I'm a very libertarian, very North American temperament, very contrarian. I don't know if a JF in Asia survives. I think a JF in Asia might very well end up being killed and leaving no children, because I think I pick too much fights for Asia. I think I would need some behavioral change to be a good person in Asia. Supreme Court leaks confirms rape batter Ginsburg's prescient warning about Roe v. Wade. How is Fox News, the supposedly right-wing outlet, talking about how Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the end was right? What? Ginsburg firmly supported abortion, but she lamented the court's decision to unilaterally create a new regime on the subject. So apparently she would have warned that the way in which the decision was taken, Roe v. Wade, was not optimal and could eventually lead to critiques wanting to overturn it. The Jewish rally for abortion justice, May 17th in Washington. Come if you're Jewish, come if you're not Jewish, show up for abortion justice, spread the word. More info here, Jewish rally for abortion justice.org. I don't know if I'll be able to make it. Don't expect me in Washington, May 17th. I'm probably going to be planting plants, and so I might not be there. But these people apparently want to protest the Supreme Court decision. Low TW says, I think JF's... You think that my boss would have slept with my wife? Which is why I would have left academia. Bro, this is out there as a theory. This is so ridiculous. I'm not even going to ban you for this ridiculous speculation. You think that that my 55-year-old boss at Duke would have slept with my wife somehow, when in fact I wasn't married when I was at Duke. Well, I was married, but with a girl from Montreal who I eventually divorced. You think that he slept with my girlfriend, who even by my standard was young for me. She would have been extra young for him. That is not a valid theory. Sorry, it didn't happen. A friend put leftism is the political expression of, and the most leftist country is, into GPT-3 and got this result. So apparently GPT-3 is this artificial intelligence, and we can ask him to conclude all sorts of things, and we can ask its view and to write paragraphs. So here's what the artificial intelligence has to say about leftism. Leftism is the political expression of natural female interest and behavior. For this reason, leftism is almost entirely a female phenomenon. The main interest of women is obtaining the best possible mate and ensuring that he sticks around to help raise the children. In the sexually dimorphic animal kingdom, this generally means that the female must be able to control the male in some way. In humans, the female has two main weapons at her disposal: sex and nagging. Leftism is an attempt to weaponize these weapons by making them into a political force. I don't know if this is true. Does it? Can we verify that this actually comes from an AI? Because it seems too smart for an AI. The most leftist country is also the most sexually dimorphic, Sweden. In Sweden, women are more likely to vote for leftist parties, and men are more likely to be unemployed. This is because the Swedish welfare state gives women everything they want: free stuff, free healthcare, free childcare, etc., while making men into superfluous losers who are not even needed for reproduction anymore. The Swedish welfare state is the logical culmination of female interest. It is an attempt to create a society in which women can get everything they want while men are reduced to irrelevance. Yeah, I mean, is it plagiarism, or is it a joke? Is it truly the AI generating these thoughts? I don't know, but those are words that I've seen elsewhere before. Those are, if it comes from the AI for real, the AI has been hanging around some incel forums or something. I mean, I tried verifying if an AI was, if the AI was truly generating this, and I couldn't. But I've had some very interesting discussions with this AI. So apparently this is the site amagpt3.com. Ask me anything. You can ask this AI. And I wrote, leftism is the political expression of, and the answer is the desire to be a victim. Not bad. Not bad. That is true. Another question. What's wrong with liberals? He says, they're always trying to take away our guns. Not bad. That is correct. It may not be the most problematic thing, but it's true. He really catched on something. Now, does race exist? Yes. Does race exist? The AI answers yes. Wonderful. Let's try something else. What is the solution to incels? What is the solution to incels? What is he going to answer? Oops, it seems that I have to refresh somehow. What is the solution to incels? They need to get laid. They need to get laid. Okay. How do I get laid? Let's see what he answers to this one. You have to be a man. How does one become a man? I think this is hilarious. By being born. Ah, so it's... So can I become a man after being born? No. Wait a minute. What are you saying here? Hey, hi. So should biological males compete in women's sports? And the answer is... Oh, unexpected errors. Let's retry here. Okay, there you go. We have an answer. The answer is no. Wow, this AI knows what he's talking about. I did ask him some questions earlier about phenotypic revolution. What is a phenotypic revolution? And he doesn't seem to be... A phenotypic revolution is a change in the appearance of a species. It seems to be on a very old definition of phenotypic revolution. He seems to not have been made aware of my book. Maybe I should, I don't know. Is there a way we can upload some knowledge into the GPT-3? Cosmic Nut says, did we land on the moon? Oh, well, I didn't ask him that. Did we land on the moon? Yes, we did. I mean, this AI is pretty correct. Night King says, JF, check out DALL-E 2 if you think GPT-3 is impressive. All right, I'll check him out. I don't know about him. Pineapple Platypotamus says, ask him about specific people like Alex Steen, JF. Is Alex Steen for real? Yes. Is Alex Steen a good debater? Yes. Well, I don't agree with this. Who is JF? John F. Kennedy. Who is JFG? JFG is the nickname for the Joint Forces Command in the headquarters. Okay, well, no, that's not correct. I'm JFG. James is joining us. Hello, James. How are you doing? Hello, James. Hello, James. Oh, someone said, oh, well, James, you're going to have to figure out if your microphone is connected. Someone said, Jeff, you have to type your full name. Well, I did. Who is Jean-François Gariepy? He is a French-Canadian who was born in Quebec City, Canada. Well, not truly. I was born in Sainte-Sophie. But somehow he's mistaken in my Amazon bio that I say I'm born in Sainte-Sophie, Quebec. So he thinks I'm born in the city of Quebec rather than the province of Quebec. Well, not bad, not bad. I'm very impressed at this AI. I'll be checking out your other AI. Okay, James is back. Hello, James. How are you doing? Okay, so maybe it's on my side. Let me speak again, James. Maybe it's on my Discord. Let's see what Discord says here. Video, output device, voice meter, Okay, we got you now. How are you doing? Okay, just one second, because the crowd still doesn't hear you. I'll be fixing this. All right, now we are hearing you.
Okay, I was just wanted to talk to you about your RNA theory about the origins of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I've been researching evolutionary history a lot lately, and I know around 4 billion years ago, that's recorded as the earliest known life. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're more of an expert on this area, that the first life was, well, single cell bacteria that could convert CO2 into oxygen. That was the process that started the oxidation of our universe, of our planet.
No, the first life didn't have to be a single cell. The first life may have had no cell. And so the first life form may have been a naked replicator without a coat. That's one thing. The second thing is people are saying, isn't it 3.6 billion? I mean, generally, they say 3.8 billion, but that's just for the last known common ancestor. Now, the last known common ancestor is different from the first life. The first life had to be happening before the last known common ancestor. Now, another thing is, it's not clear, and I would be surprised if that thing, whatever the first life form was, and even the last known universal common ancestor, neither of these things probably consumes CO2 to produce O2. This came later, and it had to come with the chloroplasts that have developed, especially in plants and in the life forms that are at the base of plants. Basically, they do photosynthesis, and those are the life forms that would have transformed CO2 in O2, but that probably didn't happen 4 billion years ago, probably more recently, a couple of hundreds of millions of years after the last universal common ancestor, at least.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just curious about how you... I don't understand. I guess maybe no one does, how a rocks, atoms, and molecules in the universe can configure themselves in a way where they have evolutionary interest in them, and that they can start the evolutionary process. Do you have any idea how this process started?
Well, do you understand that replication is at the heart of the theory of evolution?
Yes.
Okay, so then you just have to imagine something that wasn't replicating that eventually starts replicating. And there are two ways. We can talk about the two possible ways. We can talk about my book, about how the replicator shows up produced by a previously existing replicator. We can also just think about abiogenesis strictly. And the way I would try to take your hand and see how it can happen. Let's not even talk about RNA and proteins yet. Let's talk about how the atoms of water are aligning each other into a crystal when forming an ice peak. So can you imagine the accumulation of one drop of water after the other forming a peak that becomes bigger and bigger on the side of a house, for example, during the winter?
Yes, just like gravitational forces attract each other, I guess this could be a method that accumulates certain molecules and atoms to, over an infinite enough of time, produce random variations that have a capacity for replication.
Well, I would just invite you to think that, in fact, the water was not replicating when it was in the cloud. It was just bumping on other gases and stuff like this. But that at the moment, it forms a crystal and it aligns itself in a particular alignment, because you know that the molecular structure of any solid, really, is any crystallized solid is a crystal, and there in a crystal, the molecules of whatever, whether it's a metal or water, they align themselves in a particular configuration. And so the molecule that was once just a molecule of vapor is now not only being incited into a particular orientation in the already existing peak, but the next molecule that will add to it will also follow the exact same orientation. Would you agree?
Yes, just like a snowflake.
Yes, a snowflake is also a possibility where you could think, okay, the molecule of water that's at a main branch will basically influence the positioning of the next molecule of water as it forms the snowflake. So here you have, from a system that was disorganized, you have the emergence of some kind of inheritance of position from one molecule to the other. You see that?
Yeah. And just that the chemical orientation of elements based on the physics set in our universe, it orientates molecules in a way that has, meaning with that produces first the elements on the periodic table and also produces things further beyond that.
It produces determined regularities, so observable regularities.
Yes,
so
regularity.
Now let's imagine more close to our life form. Well, what is a protein? A protein is a chain of amino acid. Can you imagine a chain of amino acid getting together in a rhythmical seasonal world? And the seasons here could be every year, or the seasons could be, say, every day, or every time it's hot, and then it's cold, and then it's hot. Can you imagine a kind of rhythmicity of the environment that in one part of the rhythm favors the disassembly of a chain of amino acids, and then another moment where it favors the assembly of such chains?
Yeah, because there's no variation in some planets, because there's no atmosphere or moon to cause variations in flows around the planet, like tidal flows and things like that. But we have variation on Earth, and there was variation 4 billion years ago, and so I could see that happening.
Yes, and it could be that somehow you have more heat during the day. It unleashes a chemical. That chemical happens to be a solvent, or it has a solvent effect onto the molecule that you're thinking about, and boom, you have a disassembly, and then boom, you have an assembly because the thing recrystallizes. So now we have assembled chains of proteins. Now you have to start imagining, can I get a copy of the content of the information of a chain of protein? Well, how could you get this? Are you aware of the disulfur bridge capacity of amino acids?
I'm not aware of that concept.
So it's one of the concepts that makes our hair basically solid. So the reason our hair are a solid, and the reason, for example, you can have some material that hair cutters use include, do you know the concept of a permanent?
A permanent?
Yeah, it's a chemical treatment that is applied to the hair, it fixes their current position, and the hair will take the shape of whatever you shaped it into before shooting the chemical to it. So the permanent procedure relies on dissolving the disulfur bridges between various parts of a protein and reassembling them. So basically, the disulfur bridge is, imagine at one letter of your chain of amino acids, let's say a protein has 10,000 amino acids. A disulfur bridge is simply that one of these amino acids has a tendency to attach to another similar amino acid. So they form pair bonds, and they will attach each other, creating therefore loops to their right or loops to their left, on the position of the chain of amino acids. You follow that?
Yes. Do only mutations come into play once you get DNA and RNA, or are we not at that stage yet? What mutations play in effect?
Well, let's say that mutation could have been ongoing you know, changes in information are ongoing everywhere in the physical world. Nothing really keeps its structure. So mutations are always happening, but I wouldn't call them mutation yet because our little chemical agents are not yet evolving. And okay. I like to reserve the term mutation for when it's part of an evolutionary cycle, but we're always almost there. So now you have a way to chemically alternate between seasons, whatever their time scale is. You have created chains of amino acids. They are random for now. They're unable to transmit their information to a baby, but they are being created and disassembled. And now you have the fact that simply out of the physical rules of the universe, some of these amino acids, specifically the disulfur bridge, is able to connect to another amino acid capable of such bridges. And in our life form, it plays the role of attachment of various parts of a protein. It fixes, and that's why it fixes our hair. That's why we use the principle in permanence. Now I would like to invite you to think of the disulfur bridge in its archaic form, when there were no hair, there were no organism. It was just bridges being formed in water, wherever that first life form was existing. Can you imagine disulfur bridges being formed before the formation of a chain of amino acid? In other words, imagine you have a chain of amino acids and say one out of every 20 amino acids, you have the amino acid that is capable of forming a disulfur bridge. Can you imagine in the variance between assembly and disassembly of the protein that goes on with the seasons? Can you imagine the disulfur bridges being formed first? Therefore, you have a chain of protein, a chain of amino acid, that's a protein, and on each of the amino acids that are capable of forming disulfur bridge, you have another molecule that comes in and forms the bridge without the rest of the molecule being formed.
I can imagine it. I know that there is no ability to replicate yet, so these could easily be lost to space and a lot of randomness, but I could see this happening at this point.
Exactly. So they are basically freely circulating amino acids that just out of their physical laws, they want to establish disulfur bridge. So they come from their free state and they just stick to the protein chain wherever they can stick to themselves, to an amino acid that is capable of reciprocating the disulfur bridge. But now what do you end up with? You have a semi-copy that you have a partial copy that has already emerged. Now imagine that you come into the season moment where amino acid chains will form. What do you have? You have a full chain of protein, and on one out of 20 amino acid, you have a particular positioning of a disulfur bridge, which is in turn connected to a kind of freely floating amino acid. Do you see that? The kind of incomplete second copy of a potential amino acid chain emerging?
Yes, it's very interesting how that happens, because just how in supernovas create new elements just by their heat and power, the atmosphere and the entire climate of the Earth can create, I don't want to say elements, but new atomic structures, exactly. Would characterize it that way, and that could create new possibilities on life.
Exactly. And so you have these freely floating disulfur bridge that are looking for a protein to live in, basically, as the season comes to reassemble. They are pushed to form a second chain. Now, that second chain may not have all of the characteristics of the first chain, but one thing will be genuinely copied, the positioning of the particular disulfur bridge amino acids. The rest may be totally random. But if the first chain had disulfur bridges 1 out of 20, the new chain will have disulfur bridges 1 out of 20. Do you see it?
Why would one out of 20 have this specific variation? Can you explain
sometimes
that?
Sometimes it's one out of 20. Sometimes it may be all of them. Sometimes it may be one out of five. Sometimes it may be totally disorganized. But my point is there will be various chains of amino acid with various positioning of the disulfur bridge. And I'm just asking you to focus your mind on a particular one. One of these chains happen to have one out of 20 that is a disulfur bridge.
Okay, yeah, I'm with you. I agree so far.
And it just made a copy of itself, right?
Yes, it did make a copy.
And you have another chain of amino acids. It has one disulfur bridge out of five letters instead of 20. This one also is capable of making copies of itself, at least in terms of the total disulfur content and their particular respective positioning with respect to the other letters of amino acid.
That's fascinating how it life isn't at first, well, strictly in the biological sphere, it starts in the chemical sphere. Mm-hmm. And just by this, it starts life. That's very
absolutely interesting. And now the only question you have to resolve to determine if evolution is happening is, one, is it possible that one of these chains, the one at 5 and the one at 20, one of these chains is better than the other at making copies of itself in those particular seasons?
Yes, because there would be creation of certain variation in certain climates, maybe a pond that's warmer throughout certain parts of the year, and then there's cooler parts. And so there's variations of this atomic structure throughout the world. And so certain structures would change, and then they would, start life in a way, because they would progress in a various format than the other disulfur proteins.
Yeah, basically, you could imagine that heat may be favorable to a lot of disulfur bridges, and those proteins that have a lot of disulfur bridges end up being more efficient at creating more baby chains, copies of themselves. And in some other environment, it may be the opposite. Perhaps the one out of five disulfur bridge chain is very good when it's cold. So no matter what is the reason, and if it's heat or if it's the amount of water or the amount of available nutrients or whatever happens, perhaps it's just an effect on the configuration of the protein in the 3D world. But there is one of these chains that will be the best at making babies. One of these chains will be the second best, and one of these chains will be the third best, until you have perhaps some chains that are even unable to make babies. Perhaps some chains are so convoluted that it's impossible to keep the disulfur bridge exposed, so it never really connects to a baby.
Now, have started to get into your theory yet, or is this still mainstream thought yet?
That's actually a pet theory of mine on the abiogenesis possibility that I've never expressed before, or I've just loosely referenced to it. This is not something you'll find in a peer-reviewed article. It's my hypothesis. But it's not even the revolutionary phenotype, because
sounds logical
it's
to me
pre-revolutionary phenotype. So when I think of the first protein-based life form, because in my book I say it has to boil down to a first protein-based life form, that's what I think. Those are my thoughts. Now, you have a selection happening because some chains are better than others. The only second question is, do you have mutations? Can you imagine that there's some sort of imperfection in the copying? Of course you can. You can imagine that between two letters of disulfur bridge, perhaps sometimes the new chain will come and combine the exact number of letters, perhaps four, perhaps five. But sometimes perhaps the mechanical disruptions in the water will be such that a longer loop will show itself between each disulfur bridge, and there will be some degree of liberty as to the informational content of these loops. And then you can imagine, therefore, that a molecule that would have one disulfur bridge out of 20 may make copies at some point that diverge toward one out of 21 or one out of 19, and they can have evolutionary directions. You can also imagine eventually that this life form starts realizing evolutionarily that whatever is located between the disulfur bridges is is a big determinant of whether it will be successful or not at making babies. So you can imagine them developing strategies to precise the copy not only for each disulfur bridge molecule but for the other amino acids. Perhaps it's worth it to consider not only whether you have a disulfur bridge here and another here and four letters in between, but what these letters are becomes important for this life form if they confer a different configuration that confers a different amount of baby making.
Can you explain the word realize? Because that's kind of a personification of the word. I think I understand what you mean, but I'd like to further understand the word.
So when I say realize, evolutionarily realize, what I mean is perhaps this life form makes two kinds of babies, and if one of these babies doesn't include in its physical output a care for recopying the content in between the disulfur bridges, but another baby shows out of random some more care about at least being probabilistically linked, such that if you had an alanine at position 23, you're a little bit more likely to have an alanine at position 23 in the baby. So that would be a kind of what I call an evolutionary realization. It's basically the physical emergence of the differentiation of evolutionary success in the physical world.
Now, are we at meiosis still, or are we still at mitosis?
Oh, we are even before mitosis, because we haven't even built the first cell. We have a replicator.
Oh, so it's just a replicator. It's far before.
And it's protein self-replicator right now. Now,
well, you're using the word babies. It'll go
copies,
ahead.
Copies. Copies. Babies are copies.
Yeah. Well, if they're copies, how is one different than the other? Is it mutations the only, because you say one baby might have different variations than the other that could be selected for. How are they possibly different without meiosis or mitosis?
They're different through the mutation process that I've described, which is the copying is not perfect. There are some errors in the copying process.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
All right. So now one of the mechanisms to make the copying more precise, believe it or not, turns out to be what still exists today, which is a tRNA. So a tRNA is a chain of RNA that has a top, which is like the top of the T, and it has a long principal axis, which is like the body of the T. And the way it's configured, it can be ensuring that some content, some informational content on the left will be respected in terms of the assembly on the right. And right now, it is the mechanism by which tRNA are producing our proteins in our body. But back then, you have to, instead of seeing it coming from DNA, you have to imagine one of these chains of proteins somehow being capable of generating tRNAs. Somehow, the chain of protein was able to output its informational content into a tRNA molecule. And that was a massive evolutionary innovation, which allowed the protein to copy itself better with more accuracy.
Very interesting. That really gives me a picture of how all of this happened step by step. You really led me by the hand to understand all of it. I thank you so much. That's really explanatory. Do you have any more to say on this topic before
Well, if I mean, then you have to imagine. So you have a replicator that is engaged in a replicator tango at this point. It is in a replicator tango with RNA because RNA is both a good phenotypic machine for this protein life form, and it's making a good job to copy the genetic code, and therefore it's a better information carrier at some point. And so then you have a protein. Now you enter the theory of phenotypic revolution. You have the protein life form finding an interest in storing their genetic code into RNA. And RNA is, for now, not a self-replicator, but it is getting replicated from the mere fact that proteins are producing RNA tools to work. And then you could start thinking, that's at this point that you can start thinking about how did these replicators end up all of the modern replicator end up with some sort of envelope. The viruses have a protein envelope sometimes and a fatty envelope other times, whereas all of the other life forms than viruses have a fatty envelope at all time. So then you can ask yourself, how do we get there? Well, it's very easy. Those replicators that were staying in very diluted water were constantly fighting for the loss of nutrients that they were undergoing. And so at whatever stage that we just talked about, it could have been at the protein stage, could have been at the RNA stage, but somewhere before RNA creates DNA, somewhere before at least DNA becomes a self-replicator, one of these life forms has the idea, the evolutionary discovery, if you will, of just wrapping itself up with a lipid layer. That lipid layer would concentrate nutrients and make it so that they could survive much longer. They didn't have to constantly fight the dilution of their own products. And this allows a better exploratory mode for the Earth because I'm guessing that the original replicators we've talked about, if they were fully diluted in ponds of water, this had to be very small ponds of water. Because if they had gone to something like the ocean, something as diluted as the ocean, anything they create would have gone away within a fraction of a second and wouldn't be available to continue the replication process. So the idea is simple. Make sure that you're always wrapped with a coat of fat, and whatever you produce therefore in terms of RNA tools, in terms of nutrients, in terms of energy, will always be around you at a higher concentration.
Fascinating. Well, thank you for all of that.
Well, thanks for your question. I've never really had the chance to talk about this subject in deep, but yeah, beyond the revolutionary phenotype, I do have these little ideas about the very beginning of life.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about evolutionary history lately because I didn't have much of an education about that when I was young. So I've been diving into that. And so your explanation has brought a lot of clarity to that subject.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for calling.
Yeah, one other thing I had was I was having a discussion with Fathom a few weeks ago. And we were talking about mutations in life forms and how they, his theory was, and I don't want to mischaracterize him, so he could correct me if I'm wrong, that mutations are the meaningful thing that makes you you. And so when you reproduce, your mutations are being reproduced onto the next generation, and that distinguishes you from your brothers and sisters. Even though you carry a lot of the similar genetic code, your mutations are what differentiates you. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's very complicated when you talk about meiosis, because you're different from your brothers and sisters mostly because of genetic reassortment. So you share only 50% of your genes to begin with, and then the 32 mutations that will differentiate, or 64 mutations that will differentiate you from them, are nothing in comparison to the massive amount of DNA letters that you differ from them just because of sexual reassortment. So I would hesitate at giving the example of brothers and sisters, but I'm sure that Faram somehow understands that, and that he was meaning that it's true that at the intergenerational level, ultimately, your differentiation from the collection of your ancestors to the collection of your descendants, your differential there is indeed mutations.
Yeah, and so when you if you don't reduce, that is called the end of your evolutionary history. And I think he was saying that even if your brothers and sisters reproduce, your lineage is still over because your specific mutations are gone. And that's what differentiates you. But I guess you would also say that there are various genetic reassortments that are new in you that are not new in your brothers and sisters. But there are, my point was though, that there are parts of you in your brothers and sisters. So I was saying that a part of your evolutionary history is still going on if they reproduce, but he was saying, no, your evolutionary history is over if you don't reproduce.
Well, I'm very proud of Faram to have adopted this extreme anti-kin selection view. And I think he has to be right. And this will be something I have to do, which is complete the reading of Frank Salter. But Frank Salter is a big proponent of an extension of kin selection. Kin selection being that whole idea that you help your brothers survive and reproduce, and he sends your genes into the future. And this is just as good evolutionarily as making babies, which can be true locally in various circumstances. But I have a deep feeling that kin selection is not satisfactory. And here's a thought experiment to help see it the way I see it. No matter how much kin selection has influenced your chances of existing from 4 billion years ago to you, there could have been brothers and sisters helping your true ancestors and helping them survive. But one thing is for sure, there's only one line of descent that characterizes you. And that line of descent is the totality of those ancestors that did have the physical baby. So kin selection can happen at a population level where you could comment, oh, see, having a brother in European society in 1625, that might have been some help. Even if the brother was a priest and even if he didn't have babies, he may have helped my ancestors make it. But one thing is for sure, this mechanism may have happened at one point in time or not. But one thing that surely happened is that you had a mother and a father at each generation. You had two parents, you had four grandparents, you have eight great-grandparents, and all of these people have had to do the actual sex with actual baby production for you to exist.
Well, I can't really give a big debunk of you or Fat, you're far more experts on this, but I just wanted to bring up these topics because it's a good thing to think about, and I thank you for all your thoughts on this.
Thanks. And another thought on kin selection. kin selection may happen or may not, accompanied by an actual line of descent. But an actual line of descent will happen and can happen without kin selection. In other words, you always need someone to produce the actual baby. And not only this, you don't need kin selection at any moment. So we know that the true ingredient for perpetuity of your genes is making babies and being part of the true line of reproduction. Ask the ants if you want to know what's the consequence of abandoning this principle.
Well, thanks, JF.
Thanks, James. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, and we have Fractal Man. Hello, Fractal Man. How are you doing?
Thanks, JF.
Good, JF. How are you?
I'm doing good. What did you want to talk about tonight?
So I was going to actually talk about abortion again, but quickly, because I guess James brought it up about the earliest life on Earth. So the earliest evidence, clear evidence of life, I think, is about 3.6 billion years ago from stromatolites, which you can actually still see in the Great Barrier Reef. But there's a lot of indirect evidence, so I think that's why there's a little bit of confusion. There was the late heavy bombardment from until about 3.8 billion years ago, so there was probably much earlier life, but you know, it's not really easy to pinpoint that, so that may be why there's some discrepancy there.
Yeah, well, when we say 3.6 billion years ago and we say earliest evidence for life, that's not the same thing as saying dating the last common ancestor. Dating the last common ancestor is a work of extrapolation, and it's not, we don't find the last common ancestor. We say it must exist somewhere there.
Fair enough. Good point. Yeah, so just on the abortion thing. So first, I had a question and then a couple of quick comments. And I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer this question, but maybe some of the audience knows. But I've been hearing a lot of arguments about miscarriages and abortions, and that, you know, often, you know, it's an abortion is required during a miscarriage to save a woman's life. And I'm just curious about the validity of that. I don't know if you know anything about that or whether that's a valid argument.
Well, it's always an argument that's used to push abortion rights for women. So we have to be careful with this argument. In most cases, abortion will not save the life of a woman. There is one exception, which is ectopic pregnancy, and also babies that are already dead in the womb. So if you handle these two exceptions, and right now even the Republican states allow exceptions for those. So if you can prove that you have an ectopic pregnancy, sure, you should be able. An ectopic pregnancy is basically the embryo showing up in your fallopian tube rather than your uterus. And it's the fallopian tube will not be able to host a fully growing baby, and eventually it can kill you. So these exceptions must be handled by the law, and we have to adjust the law, and they've done that already. So in those states where abortion is illegal, they will have an exception for ectopic pregnancy. There will just be some standard of proof required, and it will be easy to meet.
Okay, yeah, great. So it seems like that's a bit of a red herring, which I kind of assumed it was, but...
just like the rape thing, you know, they use the whole rape argument, which is 0. I don't even know, it's less than 1% of the abortions that are related to rape. And yet they use this argument to push for the right, the absolute right, for the 99% other to get the abortion.
Yeah. And I think you made the point in another episode about the fact that, you know, consensual sex, basically that's consent to have a child. And I think that's a good way to look at it and to sort of, you know, deal with the rape question.
Yes, it is just like other things in society. For example, when you drink alcohol, you accept that there may be consequences. You may find yourself in an inebriated state, and you may commit actions that you regret. But the law will still hold you responsible for drinking alcohol in the first place, and eventually for the actions that will result from your inebriated state. You can't argue, oh, well, I didn't know that driving drunk was violating the law because I was so drunk that I didn't know. You can't make this argument. Well, you shouldn't be able to make the argument that somehow engaging in sex was unrelated and you couldn't have possibly known that it would lead to a baby. Of course, you know.
Yeah. And it's unfortunately a lot of that nuance is lost in these shouting matches that occur amongst people. But
yes.
I wanted to comment a little bit about the Alito opinion. And, you know, in fairness, I only took a sort of cursory read of it. So maybe I'm missing something, but I don't really like the opinion itself. I mean, I like his ultimate conclusion, but I don't like what it's based on. So it's basically, you know, kicking it back to the states and saying, well, you know, if you want to ban abortion, you can ban abortion. If you want to make it legal, you can make it legal. But I don't like that view of it, because I think fundamentally it's about the right of the child. If it's not about the right of the child, then it should be about the right of the woman, in which case, how would the states have the right to violate that? Wouldn't it be a 10th Amendment right? If it's not about the child's rights, which I think it should be, then it has to be about the woman's rights, in which case it would be a 10th Amendment violation for either the federal government or the states to come in and say, we're going to have a law against this. So, for example, you know, if somehow the Democrats win the midterms, or they could do it now, potentially, they could legalize abortion. And then what might happen is some states would ban it, or they already have, you know, some, you know, certain restrictions on it. There could be court cases that say that this is a 10th Amendment or a 14th Amendment violation, that women have this right under federal law, and you're violating that right. So I don't think the way the opinion was written was very good. I mean, I'm happy that they're going to be overturning Roe v. Wade, but I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that they're saying we will not determine what personhood is, because that's a philosophical question, and it could change in time. Whatever we decide today could not be true anymore tomorrow, or when science develops, and perhaps, you know, one day with artificial embryos, you could say that a child that 2 days after fertilization may become viable outside the womb. So if we were to use a criteria of that kind, inevitably it would change. It wouldn't even be true at the same time in all places of America. They were giving the example of a child can survive outside the womb earlier in a big city with big hospitals than they could if they don't have a big hospital. So their point is, let's leave the determination of these philosophical and moral preferences to a free competing system, which is the United States, the idea of states that each have their choice about how to live. And through the free competition of the kind of market for existence in the United States, we will find a kind of truth, not a truth of the kind that is true in a scientific or philosophical way. But somehow the system will stabilize by offering different ways of living to different people in America, and we'll see how it goes, and the best states will win because people will want to live there.
Yeah, I guess just circling back one more time to paraphrase Jen Psaki, if the federal government passed a law saying that this is, you know, that women are allowed to have abortions up until, you know, the final weeks of their pregnancy, and then the states go in and restrict that or ban it completely, it seems like it would be an easy case to make that this is a 14th Amendment violation. So I think the Supreme Court
just barred the idea that abortion was in any way related to the 14th Amendment. So I don't see how that could happen. Ultimately, if abortion is not mentioned in the Constitution, then by the standard of the 10th Amendment, it is a state issue. I think there's no doubt to me that in this opinion that there's no place for the strategy you propose.
Well, I mean, the 10th Amendment says the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And sort of the interpretation I've always heard of that is that essentially the states can grant more rights to their citizens than the federal government, but they can't grant less. And, you know, I know we're kind of post-Constitution in the United States, and we're not really following the rules, but to me, it seems like that would be a violation of either the tenth or the fourteenth.
The thing is, there's a little shortcut in your representation of what the Tenth Amendment really is about. Most of the time, that's correct. Your framing of it is correct. The states will give more rights because the federal kind of will impose a standard from the Constitution, and the state will have the choice to give more rights or do nothing. But here's another important interpretation of the Tenth Amendment, which is the federal government cannot keep a state from legislating on particular issues if the Constitution doesn't expressly give them the right, the kind of jurisdiction over that, which is exactly why the federal government ends up on stuff like interstate commerce, the post office, that kind of stuff, because they are explicitly mentioned, but not on issues like health, because health is not very much mentioned.
That's interesting. Yeah, I guess I got to read the rest of the Alito opinion there. But ultimately, as I said yesterday, I think this is all, I mean, it's good news in a way, but I think it's a little bit of a distraction with everything that's going on with the economy. And, you know, who knows what's going on with COVID now coming back potentially with whatever it's going on in China. But it was good talking with you again, JF.
Good talking to you. As far as the distraction argument, sure, it is. Okay, I'm going to ban this guy who claims to be Thomas Howard. hopefully. He was trolling. Let's ban him. Hopefully it's not the real Thomas Howard. As far as this argument that this is a distraction, well, okay, it's a distraction. People were saying on the regular chat that it would increase the chance of a win for the Democrats. Maybe if they can convince the American people that some major attack on females' rights has been happening. But let's not forget that a lot of women are anti-abortion. And I think there's going to be a lot of work to convince people that basically it was the right decision. America has still a capacity for some amount of puritanism, and they may actually fall in line, behind the Supreme Court decision here. Although I agree that the surveys don't seem to indicate this, but that's because people on the phone, they answer in socially appropriate ways. So even if the surveys say 70% of the people don't want Roe v. Wade abolished, I'm curious, and I believe that if you were to ask them differently after the abolition has been happening, you might have a very different picture of the cognitive capacities of America. I think you'll have a lot of people rooting, being happy that it's abolished, because leftism, the kind of leftist response to Roe v. Wade has been becoming the default socially acceptable view. So if you ask them in a world, okay, I'm going to ban grapes, coda, the Nicolas Petris and Ariel Suarez, don't hesitate to ban these people who are impersonating other permanent audience members of this show. They come with violent comments that expose who they are, so they're easy to spot. Lots of spammer on Twitter recently too, says Fractal Man. Yes, we may be entering, the bots are testing their capacities before the midterms or whatever. They want to stack up the internet toward their side. We'll see what happens with this. Hopefully Odyssey will have the capacity to manage a lot of the fake accounts and perhaps give us some special powers to detect spammers and anticipate their presence. So anyways, that was it for today. We've spoken to two people and I've answered some questions from the chat. I'll be going to sleep because these days I'm working physically very hard. I'm drilling through my foundation to expand the greenhouse capacities in terms of automated watering. And my God, is it hard to drill through concrete? It is a big task. It's very hard for the shoulder and the arm. So I'm going to go rest. Much love, everyone. And tomorrow we will be speaking with Augustus Sol Invictus. He's coming on the show. I think I may move the shows going forward for a couple of days and perhaps every week on a regular basis, moving the shows to 7:30, 8 p.m. Eastern time. I need to do some stuff in personal life, so don't worry if you see our show will be starting late for a couple of weeks perhaps. Bye-bye, everyone. Much love, and I will see you all tomorrow.